stories of neurodivergence, yet you can't find the ones that speak to your life. Utopia the Campaign aims to platform the voices of neurodivergence across different communities and life circumstances, so we find the words to get the support we need. Join me, Samantha Hugh, Director of ADHD Girls, as I uncover hidden stories of neurodivergence that come from a few, but speak to so many parts of our lives.
Hi, hello everyone. Welcome to the Utopia podcast campaign. I'm really happy today to have Gwen Jansen on the podcast. Welcome, welcome Gwen. How are you?
Thank you so much, Dr. Hugh. I'm doing very well, thank you. How are you this morning?
I'm good as well. Can I start by asking you to tell me a bit about you, what you do, and what is a neurodiverse experience that you identify with?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am 33 years old, currently living in the United States, was raised in upstate New York, and currently live in Texas. All of my background is in healthcare. I started my career as a bedside nurse. That was always my passion and my calling, was to do maternity nursing. So most of my career has been in the labor and delivery and maternity care space. And then just through some, you know, unexpected opportunities, was able to move into nursing leadership, where I really found a passion and a calling within the niche of nursing. So I was able to get a couple of advanced degrees focusing in leadership, and spend over the past 5 years within the leadership space in healthcare. I currently do work on the medical industry side, where I'm doing some education and in-servicing around med tech. And I am an adjunct nursing professor for one of the colleges here in Texas for nursing. So I have a lot of healthcare background. That has been my primary career path. And when we talk about neurodiversity, I was actually not diagnosed with ADHD until earlier this year, so at age 33. So I went through the first over three decades of my life, you know, kind of at a loss and feeling a little bit directionless, because I was experiencing these struggles that didn't seem to make sense, right? I was doing all of this, you know, personal and professional development work, but none of it was landing, and no one seemed to be able to give me the answers for why I was the way that I was, or why I was experiencing the world in the way that I did. So it was actually through my nephew's diagnosis of ADHD that led both my sister and I to seek diagnosis and really gain a lot of clarity around kind of what our experience had been in the world and in the workplace up until this point. And since that time, I have just spent, countless hours researching, you know, neurodiversity in all of its forms, because I am also thinking that I probably need to be assessed for autism as well. So just really doing as much research as I can to find out as much information as I can, and really help to, the people in my life and the people that I'm connected with, to better understand neurodiversity and how it can impact us really across our lifespan and across all facets of our lives.
Oh, that's really interesting, Gwen. I mean, I love hearing your story and the fact that, you know, you've been like literally, you know, worked so hard your whole life and, you know, worked your way up to a leadership position in nursing. And now you want to kind of advocate the medical community, right, about, how neurodivergence show up in people's lives, and especially in professionals' lives. And through our conversation before, you mentioned that you grew up in a family with a lower income background, but mm-hmm. that your sister and you have worked so hard to create opportunities for yourselves and have tried to improve in this area. And personally, I identify with that too, having come from, you know, difficulties myself from a young age. How do you think this impacted you in terms of your professional work and your leadership roles? Or maybe start with professional work first.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, it was something that I consider myself extremely lucky, and I'm sure my sister would echo that, that we kind of always knew we wanted to be nurses. So there was that sense of kind of foundational, okay, this is at least a start on the path to where we want to go, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and we were the first, you know, out of our parents to go to college, right? My mom has since earned a college degree, which we're very proud of her for. But my sister and I were the first in our family to, you know, go to college when we consider, you know, kind of the fact that both of our parents didn't go. You know, and it was something that, you know, growing up in that type of environment, you know, we were very fortunate in the fact that my mom was always an incredibly hard worker. We were raised in a single parent household. My mom raised my sister and I on her own. And she always worked very hard. So we were lucky in the sense that we always had a roof over our head and clothes on our back and whatnot. But it did mean, you know, hand-me-down and secondhand clothes. And, you know, sometimes we would go to the, you know, the church food pantry, you know, to, you know, to be able to eat that week and whatnot. And I think it was really a motivating factor for my sister and I to try and make sure that, you know, that we were pursuing career paths and goals that would allow us to have a little bit more financial security and stability as far as the position that we were in as adults. I personally don't have children, but like I was mentioning, my nephew, who is now 7 and a half, I know that was a big driver for my sister as well, right? Wanting to provide him with an experience that was different than ours growing up. So there is that sense of motivation there to say, this is what we've experienced. And, you know, certainly a lot of credit to our mom for all of the work that she always did to take care of our family. But how can we then use that as a foundation to build upon and maybe create a different experience for ourselves as adults and then for that next generation with my nephew?
Right. Can I just ask a little bit more about your beginnings? It's because that sounds incredibly hard and, you know, also fascinating to me. With your mother, you know, working so hard, you know, and I often hear that, you know, when one is a single parent. How did that impact, you know, you and your sister? Like, were you both at an age where you could be helpful, you know, to, like, you could help her or be self-sufficient? Or you had to learn to be self-sufficient?
I would absolutely say so. I would say that we, you know, kind of grew up pretty quickly. You know, my parents separated when my sister and I were six. And even before that, you know, my father was not, you know, really very much in the picture. And in the same year that my parents split up, my mom lost her mom, who she was very close to. And like I said, at the time, my sister and I were six, we're twins. So when I say that we were the same age, you know, so, you know, it was a very challenging time for my mom, who we have, through all of our research and everything that we've learned, you know, have realized that my mom is also ADHD, you know, potentially, you know, some other things mixed in there as well. But, you know, she was born in 54, right? So grew up in a generation that, you know, approaches mental health and, you know, and things like that very differently. Mm-hmm. And, you know, back then ADHD really wasn't even a thing that we talked about. Right. And, mm-hmm. And so growing up with a parent that experienced such significant emotional turmoil, you know, being thrust into this position of being a single parent with two young girls to raise, you know, and also experiencing these struggles herself, but unfortunately not having any sense of a guiding force, right? She didn't recognize that she had ADHD until my sister and I started doing, you know, more research into it earlier this year. And now she is, you know, in her late 60s. So, you know, when you kind of think about the implications of that, it was pretty significant because you have two undiagnosed children trying to come up and figure out their way in the world, growing up very quickly, right? In a household that needed their support, needed their, you know, their engagement with how to make sure that the household ran smoothly. I'm not sure if you have the same saying, you know, in the UK, but we were latchkey kids where, you know, when we were pretty young, my mom worked so much that she couldn't be home after we got home from school. So it meant we just kind of let ourselves into the house, locked the door behind us. And, you know, it was, hey, don't answer the door for anyone until I get home, right, type of thing. You know, and we started doing whatever we could at a young age to kind of, you know, earn money to help the household. So my sister and I were babysitting at a very young age, you know, and then as soon as we could, you know, get into the workforce doing that, right? You know, we both worked full time throughout late middle school and high school and certainly through college and beyond. So probably started working full time around 14 or 15 years old in addition to school. You know, so it was really interesting in the sense that I think it gave us this sense of, you know, maturity at a young age, and really, you know, had to work very hard to make sure that, you know, that our family continued to be supported and, you know, and whatnot. And sometimes that meant, you know, handing over some money to pay the mortgage or, you know, emptying savings accounts to pay taxes and, you know, and things like that. Right. And it was the way that we grew up and, you know, full credit to our mom for, again, all of the hard work that she did. And, you know, it certainly wasn't easy for any of us, right? You know, it was very challenging for her to navigate this situation, but challenging for us as well, because, you know, ideally no child should have to grow up and have that level of responsibility at such a young age. And then you add on that level of undiagnosed ADHD and what that means as a parent and what that means for the two children that are being parented by, you know, someone with undiagnosed ADHD. So it was definitely a whirlwind in our house growing up. And I think that it's given us some unique perspectives and some, you know, an approach to life and to work, you know, in a way that motivated us to make sure that we were, you know, successful and that we, you know, continued our education and that we would always be able to support ourselves without having that same level of struggle.
Right. And so how do you think that, like, impacted you in terms of your professional life, you know, and maybe on your quest to getting to a leadership position in your profession?
I think that it impacted my professional life, again, when I speak from the place of motivation, right? As far as like always wanting to, you know, I'm very lucky and have worked hard to develop an extremely strong work ethic, right? You know, I approach everything with 110%. I never, you know, I never give anything, you know, less than my all. So I think work ethic was definitely impacted by that type of environment. And, you know, to be honest, Sam, you know, my foray into nursing leadership was accidental. You know, if you had asked me back then, you know, if I could ever see myself being a nursing leader, you know, I probably would have laughed at you. And I almost did laugh at the woman who offered me my first leadership job, right? You know, we were sitting in an interview because I had come in, you know, having applied for a bedside nursing role. And at the end of the interview, she was like, we have, you know, a manager position open and I think you'd be really great at it. Have you ever considered it? And I almost laughed, right? Because I'm like, I am not fit for leadership. Like, I am not this, you know, this cookie cutter, you know, in the box type of, you know, suit wearing person. And, you know, I was always outspoken about things, right? That, you know, when we talk about justice sensitivity with ADHD, I'm very guilty of that, right? Where I talk very openly about things that, you know, I feel like need improvement or necessarily, or maybe are not necessarily fair and whatnot. And in my leadership journey, I would say that my upbringing impacted that because I was always trying to make sure that I stayed grounded, right? That I remembered where I came from personally and professionally, right? And always trying to make sure that I led with a level of authenticity and compassion that was really important to me. You know, because these are values that, you know, in my upbringing and through my early professional career, I recognized that they are, you know, foundational to who I am. And I always felt that it was important to bring that into, you know, my professional life, but then especially, you know, my role as a leader.
Right. Okay. So much of it that I want to kind of explore more, you know, because you talk about your work ethic, and that's something that I've been actually been told I have, you know, amazing work ethic as well. But looking back, you know, and looking at the new lens, you know, through ADHD and maybe being autistic too, is that, you know, we give like 110%, 200%, you know, and our productivity level is so much higher than, you know, other people. You know, what these tend to lead to is this, they say perfection is burnout, but then I never really was a perfectionist. I think what I was like a hard worker, and I didn't necessarily do everything to perfection. I just did everything, you know, to the, maybe the way it should be done and maybe to the higher standard, and then burn out. You know, is that something that you resonate with?
I absolutely do. And actually, you know, I had been in leadership for about 3.5 years, the first time that I experienced really significant burnout. And it was, I definitely think largely in part to my undiagnosed ADHD, but certainly due to that, you know, that phenomena of perfectionist burnout, right? To the sense of, you know, we tend to have that all or nothing mentality, right? Where you are, it's either perfect or it's not good enough, right? And so, or at least our level of perfect, right? When you talk about like, you do things the way that they should be done, that's how we view it, right? It's like, well, what do you mean? Like, why would you do it any other way? Like, this is, you know, the standard, this is how it should be done. This is where we're setting the bar. So I don't understand why anyone would expect something different, right? And I really, really struggled in that first director role that I held, which was my second leadership position or third leadership position, but first level, you know, first director level. A lot of that was due to the fact that I had no idea that the way that I presented myself and the way that I experienced the working world and the world as a whole was through an ADHD lens, right? So I cannot even explain the number of, you know, books and courses and even these degrees that I received, right? That the time and effort and money that I was putting into trying to be my best self. And I don't know if this has been your experience at all, especially having a PhD, but my goodness, Sam, like I felt like nothing was clicking, right? To the same level that it was for other people. And when I say clicking, I mean that I would take in the information, it would resonate with me, and it would either be like, hey, that's really simplistic. Like, of course, like, why are we even talking about that? Right. And, you know, or like, wait, but I do those things. So why isn't it working for me? Right. You just have this very different experience than, you know, than your neurotypical peers, you know, and it really didn't make sense. Right. And I had a leadership team at the time that was, you know, in their defense, no one knew this was ADHD related, so they couldn't provide me resources. It's not like, you know, I shared that with them and they refused to provide resources. Nobody knew, right? But realistically, they were at a loss as well. And so it just led to a lot of negativity and really a toxic work environment that I was spinning my wheels so, you know, to no end, right? Like I was just working so hard. I was putting in, you know, 13, 14 hour days, 6, sometimes 7 days a week, you know, and it just was never enough. And so instead of taking a step back, right, and maybe reevaluating, and I tried to do that, but again, without knowing about this ADHD, all of that reflecting and self-awareness and everything, it didn't matter because I didn't know how to fix it, right? I didn't know how to hone in on what was going on and how to support myself in the working environment. And so it just ended up that I was doing more and more and more of these same things that weren't working because I didn't know what else to do. And I burned out very significantly to the point where even after I transitioned to a different role, I would say it took me a solid year and a half to kind of recover from that. And I even struggled with identity crisis, right? When I ended up, leaving that role, it was so much of like, oh my goodness, who am I, right? And my whole career has been building up to this, so now what, right? Because that didn't work out. So if this isn't it, then what is, right? And so you just have all of these things going on in your head, and it was not a fun time for sure.
Well, I totally hear everything you say, and you know, actually have parallel experience with the burnout was more like, you know, yeah, you get to a point where you're so tired and stressed and you just need to unplug from everything. Mm-hmm. And that means leaving a job. And the identity crisis you had, you know, after spending so long working on this one thing and then trying to figure out if this is really for you, and then, you know, maybe daring to try something new or something mm-hmm. else that isn't as taxing. You know, that identity crisis I had for, you know, a really long time whilst figuring it out, you know, yeah. I call it my existential anxiety, you know, but like only looking back, it seemed like one, but the whole time you're in it, just feels like, where do I belong, you know, into, you know, and that's hard, isn't it? Because like the way society is organized is that you have to choose this one thing and everyone climbs this ladder, or at least it looks like that's, you know, what everyone else is doing. But there are so many people like us who's trying to figure it out. And we end up hiding into oblivion because of, you know, our mental health suffered, you know, in that process. We don't see people, we don't talk because we don't know how to ask for help, right?
No, you hit the nail on the head with that, absolutely. You know, because, you know, especially in healthcare, which at least in the United States, even though, you know, we talk about, you know, all of these medical advancements and how, you know, we know more than we ever have, when we talk about medicine as a business, it is extremely archaic, right? Medicine, especially the acute care side, where most of my experience has been in, is run by very old-fashioned and, you know, type professionals, right, that are very much like, this is how you be a professional and this is how you be a leader. And we don't deviate from that, right? Like there is no room for any type of alternative thinking or approaches or anything like that. And so, you know, especially, you know, after getting these degrees and setting out this path for myself that I thought I was going to spend the rest of my life achieving, you know, you sit there and you're like, oh my goodness, like, I'm not good enough, right? Like I'm not made to do great things, and all of this hard work that I've put in is all for nothing, because clearly like I don't have what it takes to be successful, right? You frame, you know, your view of yourself based on the construct that society has made of A, what success looks like, B, what professionalism looks like, and C, what leadership looks like, right? And we can talk in a little bit about, you know, because I know that was something that we had discussed, you know, mm-hmm. mentioning about the lens of females, yeah. you know, even further in those struggles. But for a neurodiverse individual, you know, you do have this perpetual sense of I don't fit, right? And what's wrong with me, and why don't I fit into all of these things? Because that is the traditional path, right? And if you're not able to climb that ladder, if you're not able to follow in those same, you know, predetermined footsteps that everyone says is the path to success, you do have a lot of self-doubt, right? And you do go through that existential crisis type of like, oh my goodness, like, where do I even fit in this whole world, right? Like, if this isn't it, and I thought this was my passion, and I thought this was my life's work, where is the place for me, right? Mm-hmm. And it's so, you know, like, I've had conversations with executive coaches and professors and things like that before I knew I had ADHD, where I was like, you know, because they're like, well, what do you want to do? And I'm like, right? You're kind of like, I don't know. I know what I don't want to do based on my experiences thus far, but like, you don't know what you don't know. And I think that that's compounded even further in the neurodiverse community, because there hasn't traditionally been a safe space for us to talk about these things, for us to ask for help without worrying about the negative repercussions, right? Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, I love all the points that you make there, because it's just so true. And that's very much been my experience as well.
Yeah, I completely get it. Yeah, we know what we don't want to do because we've experienced, you know, the burnout and, you know, the pain of trying to do them. Yes. But then what do we like to do? And what I did was just kind of like whatever that felt right. And that was, you know, if I was in a space where I needed to write, I write. And then that became something else, you know, that writing became more. And I suppose maybe that's how you found your way as well. Like, you know, what just feels right at that time. So with your ADHD diagnosis, which you said you got this year at the age of 33, what made you pursue it?
So I think it was realistically when after my nephew got his diagnosis, because like I said, he's 7 and a half now. And I remember his pediatrician when he was, goodness, Sam, I think he was maybe 3 or 4. He was very little, right? The first time his pediatrician said, I think he has ADHD. And back then, you know, you have this whole negative connotation of, oh, that means they're going to pump him full of drugs. And why can't he just be a kid? Like, who, you know, like, yeah, he's hyper and he's all over the place. But like, when did that stop being childhood? And when did that start being something that you need to medicate, right? Mm-hmm. And so at the time, you know, my sister and I, because we're very close, you know, we were talking through it. And I was like, I don't even know that you can reliably diagnose that at this age. Like, he's a toddler, right? Like, he's so small, mm-hmm. you know, and like, please don't medicate him. He's so young. Like, you know, let's just try and figure it out. So, you know, a couple of years went by, and maybe when he was 5, I think he got the firm diagnosis. Right. Mm-hmm. And then when he was, I think it was when he was 6 when, you know, they started to try, you know, different medications and things. And so after he got his diagnosis, I immediately started diving into all of the research that I could find, all of the, you know, organizations that focused on ADHD. And, you know, especially because I have a nursing background and I'm an educator, you know, like, I really wanted to make sure that anything that I was looking at was high quality evidence-based information, right? And so spent a lot of time, you know, diving into what is this, what does it mean, you know, what are the different types of treatments, how can we support him as, you know, as adults in his life. And the more that I'm doing research on it, because he has, you know, hyperactive impulsive type, right, which is much more common in young boys, as I'm doing research on ADHD, and I'm looking into, you know, kind of the inattentive and the combined type, I'm like, well, that sounds like everything that I am, right? And so doing a lot more digging into it. And then, you know, as I'm looking at all of these symptoms, I was reminded that I had a therapist in my like mid-20s for a very short amount of time, because unfortunately, after I think like 4 sessions or something like that, she ended up moving out of state because she was getting married. But she was the only person, and it only came up once, so it didn't have, at that time, like a lasting, you know, impact on me. She had asked me in my mid-20s, like, has anyone ever told you that you might have ADHD? And at that time, my knowledge of ADHD was that, like, hyperactive little boy in the classroom. And I'm like, what do you mean, no? Like, that's not me, right? But then as I'm doing all of this research in adulthood, really resonating with the experiences, right? And with the symptomatology. So then you start, you know, following, you know, content creators and researchers and people that focus their work on ADHD and ADHD support. And I think it is tragic and ironically hilarious that so many people are learning that, are either self-diagnosing or learning what they need to know about ADHD from social media, right? And that's one of the reasons why I love the work that you do, is because there is a lot of misinformation on social media, but it's really unfortunate that there's enough, that's the platform that people are talking about it, where it's helping other people to say, like, hey, maybe that's what's going on with me. And that was my experience as well, is once I kind of was learning about these symptoms, I'm like, I really think that sounds like me, following content creators, and they're talking about their lived experiences. And I was like, oh my goodness, it's like they've been looking into my life this whole time. Because I think, you know, In the official DSM-5 diagnostic criteria for ADHD, even with combined and, you know, an inattentive type, there is no inclusion of the emotional piece of it. And I think that's a big factor that I want to talk about when we talk about how women specifically are impacted in the professional and leadership space, you know, with ADHD and neurodiversity. But that was the other thing, is there are all of these nuances to the neurodiverse experience that can't be captured in a diagnostic criteria. So really, it's about listening to other people's stories and how neurodiversity shows up for them to better understand how it showed up for me. And so realistically, by the time that I sought my official diagnosis, I was already very confident that that was what was going on. But for me, as a personally, it was important to have that, you know, official, you know, process. And so I ended up just, you know, kind of seeking diagnosis and all that through a psychiatric nurse practitioner here in town. But it really all started with my nephew's diagnosis, you know, and because other than that one therapist, one time, you know, no one had ever considered that ADHD was what was going on with, you know, myself or my sister, right? Through our entire lives. Yeah.
And you're right. You know, like everything you said about, you know, from the moment of actually finding out through your nephew going through the same thing, mm-hmm. and then having more information now, and not just information from medical sites, it's information from life experience as well, which, you know, didn't really exist back when we were younger. And so that really caused a huge delay, you know, in us really finding out, you know, especially in my culture, we don't think about mental health, you know, mm-hmm. nothing like that exists. And if it wasn't because of that massive, you know, change in the whole world because of the pandemic, you know, none of this would really happen. And I think in some ways happened for a reason. It kind of woke everyone up, you know, and now we're kind of focusing hopefully on trying to maybe make society a bit more accessible, you know, to people like us, you know, and it is going to take such a long time, but, you know, every little bit of, you know, even this conversation that we're sharing is going to help, you know, change mm-hmm. our mind and perception. And you mentioned also that you identify with, you know, having some long-term health conditions and yep. mental health challenges such as depression and anxiety and then trauma from your youth. And a few other things. Like, did you want to talk about this? You know, I mean, how this impact your professional and personal life?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that, you know, that's a big part of the conversation that I'm so glad that, you know, we as adults and professionals are focusing on more now as people are becoming more empowered to speak about their neurodiversity. And that's that ADHD is the psychological condition that has more comorbid factors than any other behavioral or psychological condition, right? So, and I think that that's even further compounded when you talk about late diagnosis, because, you know, I went through the, like I said, the first 33 years of my life just trying to figure it out, right? And it was a matter of, I had no idea how my brain was wired. I had no idea how that led to the way that I showed up in the world and at work. And so you develop these coping mechanisms due to your brain wiring. You develop so many levels of masking, because that's really, in my experience, that was almost always a requirement, right? Like, I could never fully be myself at work because that was never acceptable, right? Because it didn't fit into what I was supposed to be as a leader and as a professional. And so I think that, you know, depression and anxiety, not to say that obviously, we can never know if I would experience those things if I was neurodiverse or not, right? Certainly, we can't speculate on that. However, what I can say is looking back at my life with this new knowledge of, you know, ADHD and neurodiversity, I can say that a lot of my depression and anxiety stems from the fact that our society is not built to support or encourage neurodiversity in any of its forms, right? I think that, you know, you spend your whole life trying to force yourself to be something that you never will be. And there's nothing wrong with that, but you're made to feel wrong, right? Because you just can't get it. You just can't be what these other people can be, right? You just can't, well, they can do it. Why can't you do it, right? And so there's this pervasive thought process of, hey, you work, you know, yourself like a dog and it's just never enough, right? You constantly, I constantly receive these messages of, you know, never enough, unfit, you know, it's just not right. You're not right. You know, and all these things. So I definitely would say that a lot of my, you know, kind of co-occurring depression and anxiety have a lot to do with the fact that our world is just not built with the neurodiverse mind in mind, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we have so much value and so many, you know, unique talents and benefits to bring to the table, you know, in our professional and our personal lives. But none of these are celebrated, right? Because they've always been viewed as negative things, or because they're different, they're wrong. So I can say that from that standpoint, you know, I can definitely see that the late diagnosis piece has been a big factor for me. But I do know it also co-occurs in people that received a diagnosis in youth, right? And so I think that kind of furthers that, you know, that assertion of these things stem from the fact that our society is just not built to support us, mm-hmm. right? Or to encourage us.
Yeah.
You know, and even physical things, right? You know, when you and I were talking, you know, I mentioned obesity. Like, I have been overweight my entire life, right? I have, you know, tried every diet and exercise regimen under the sun. You know, I've been able to stick with things for a little while, but then always fall back and you know, whatever. So physical health has always been, you know, has been a struggle for me for sure. You know, and again, I think that a lot of that has to do with, you know, with not understanding my ADHD symptoms or being able to set up systems for support for myself during my formative years. Right. So now in adulthood, I'm trying to like fight that battle to create these, mm-hmm. you know, support systems and make them stick,
okay.
You know, and so just that whole, you know, that struggle with executive functioning, but also, you know, and this is a whole other conversation, but, you know, using food as stimulation and emotional comfort and all of those things, they definitely impact your professional life and, you know, and everything, because a healthy body, you know, definitely adds to a healthy mind. Not to say it's mm-hmm. the fix all for everything, but it does have very positive impacts on neurodiversity symptoms. And so when you have, when you struggle with those, you know, the aspect of physical health, certainly those are going to show up in you know, in pretty obvious mm-hmm. ways at work as well.
Sure, of course. That sounds completely, you know, valid. Everything you said, you know, about your experience of being late diagnosed, and do agree that the mental health challenges are compounded, and, you know, the never being good enough is not just in work, is it? Like, say if you have a relationship with somebody and if they say that to you, and that just brings up all this old wounds of, you know, just not being understood. And that is really the main thing for all of us neurodivergents, especially, you know, those who are diagnosed later in life. I want to ask you this one last question. And based on your professional experience, you know, having been in the nursing profession and being a leader and now wanting to advocate within the medical community, you know, through your experience of seeing maybe how things are done, whether it is, you know, how patients, you know, are being treated, and, you know, maybe also how healthcare professionals are being trained, do you think something can be changed or, you know, has to change about the way, you know, neurodivergence, you know, it's being, the knowledge of it, you know, is being spread to the medical community so they can do a better job?
I absolutely do, because it's been my experience that even people in the mental health space, so the therapist that I see now is a licensed clinical therapist. She's not like a psychiatric, you know, or psychiatrist or you know, anything like that. And when the first time that I told her that I thought I had ADHD, she was like, well, maybe ADD, because you're not always bouncing all around during our calls, right? Because we do virtual meet, you know, appointments still. And, you know, A, you know, being in this world, right, we know that ADD is not a thing anymore, because now the correct terminology is ADHD. But even in the mental health space, there is still this pervasive misunderstanding and lack of information about, you know, ADHD and autism, right? You know, I actually read something, the other day that was talking about how ADHD and autism, you know, often co-occur, and, you know, kind of, you know, there's a lot of research that's still being done about, you know, how these two neurological conditions kind of connect and what their link is, if there is actually a link there, but they do co-occur, you know, increasingly, as we're finding. And this person online was saying, you know, that it's interesting how we see one as this god-awful, terrible thing that needs to be eradicated. Like, who would want an autistic child, right? Like, oh my goodness, that's terrible. But then the other side of it, you know, with ADHD is that it's just not taken seriously, right? When you try to explain to people how profoundly your life has been impacted by ADHD, you definitely don't get positive reception to that very often, at least has been my experience, right? People will, you know, really don't take you seriously. They don't understand. And they're often like, okay, you're just being dramatic, like, you know, and things like that. So I think that there must be a greater education and understanding within the medical community of what neurodiversity is, what it looks like, and how it presents, because we cannot even begin to hope to support the neurodiverse community if we are so steeped in stigma, right? If we still are, you know, left with all of these preconceived notions of, I know exactly what autism looks like, right? And I know exactly what ADHD looks like, and this is how it presents, and this is how it's going to impact that person. And I know you talk a lot about this, Sam, that, you know, even within the same type of neurodiversity, everyone is going to experience things differently, right? Mm-hmm. So it's so important in my mind that education has to occur, obviously for the general populace, but at least it needs to be within the medical community so that we can improve our assessment and diagnosis rates, that people aren't having to seek these things out after years of struggle and research, right? That they are being offered the support that they need from an early age so that we are decreasing the amount of these comorbid conditions that occur as a result of coping mechanisms and things like that.
Yeah, you're completely right. You know, like everything you say is just great. You know, the co-occurrences, you know, how we shouldn't, you know, treat an individual based on label, because we often have more than one, or, you know, also our brain works differently depending on, you know, what type of experiences we have. And to provide more kind of needs-based support to people. I love the work that you're doing. Are you focusing right now to advocate within the medical community? Can you tell me a little bit about, you know, where people can find you if you're, you know, doing this work?
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you. So, you know, my sister and I co-founded what we call the END Institute. So END stands for Excellence in Neurodiversity. And, you know, as it stands at this moment in time, it is really just a collaborative and a safe space for neurodiverse professionals and leaders really across any industry, right? You know, certainly, you know, would really love to connect, you know, and encourage people within the medical community to, you know, to engage with us. You know, but we want to support people even in other industries, because we know, even if it's not through the lens of healthcare, we can hopefully help them understand their experiences and support them in their neurodiversity at work. You know, and that's kind of the work that we're focusing on right now. Long-term goal would be to try and expand that, right, to support, you know, students and, you know, and parents and things like that. But currently we're really focusing on professionals and leaders, and how can we make their work experience one that is not traumatic, right? One that, you know, truly supports their strengths through neurodiversity, you know, and how can we really improve their lived experiences by reducing the negative experiences that they have in the workplace. You know, so we have, you know, we, our company has a LinkedIn page, and I post, you know, on my personal page very often, but we also do have a LinkedIn group where you can join, and it's a safe space to have very open and candid discussions about professional and leadership experiences as a neurodiverse person. We also have a group on Facebook and an Instagram page where we just, you know, share information. So all of those, if you search the END Institute, you know, they should pop up. If you're interested in joining the conversation, we would certainly love to have anyone that that would like to talk about it.
Oh, thank you so much, Gwen. Thank you for giving up your time today, you know, to really talk about this work and also your experience. You know, I can see that you have so much passion in this field, and I really wish you all the best. And I'm sure, you know, it's going to be a massive success.
Thank you, Sam. I truly appreciate you taking the time this morning, and I look forward to continuing to partner with you because I love the work that you do, and ADHD Girls is so important.
Thank you.
What did you think of this episode? If it resonates with you, do share it so we can empower other neurodivergents too. We want to open up conversations for neurodivergents across all communities, especially the ones who are underrepresented, so they can get diagnosed and find the support they need in life and work. I'm Samantha Hugh, Director of ADHD Girls, and you can invite me to speak at your organization or subscribe to my upcoming bite-sized video courses on ADHD and neurodiversity via a new learning platform called Utopia. You can find a link via my link tree within my bio on Instagram and LinkedIn. Special thanks to QBTAC for being such a wonderful collaborator throughout phase one of this campaign.